In this episode of The Treasure Hunt, I'll try something new. We're going to the theater, and we have an amazing guest. Also, it will be a crossover podcast because my guest has a podcast too, and she is recording it also and using it for her channel. So that's exciting. Her podcast is called All That and More, and you should definitely follow her. This time, we are finding out more about the characters of this new Sikorax opera we are working on. And we speak about creating new stories, about women roles in opera, and how new stories can bring us more diversity and understanding, and lots of joy, too. Yeah, same here. And we're on! So this is very exciting, Malina. We are in our rehearsal space at the Witmarhalle in Bern. And, you know, you're my extra special guest.
Yay! And I'm going to steal your podcast from my podcast.
Exactly, that sounds fabulous. So this is Malina Lee Williams Haas.
Thank you very much.
And yes, she is the wife of the composer Georg Friedrich Haas. And she also is the main character in this opera.
Even though she's not an opera singer.
More about that later. Malina and I have worked together in the past in another piece, which maybe we'll also talk about. But first, I would like to talk a bit about your character in this opera. Mm. In the last episode of my podcast, I briefly described the story and how it connects with The Tempest by Shakespeare. And you have Prospero and Miranda, and they're on this island. Prospero takes over the magical powers and rules the island. And now in this opera, Prospero loses the magic, and the original inhabitants, Sikorax, Caliban, and the spirit Ariel, find it back, and they start this healing process. Mm. Now, you are Sikorax, and I would like you to tell me something about your character, how you see it. Who is Sikorax? What happened to her? And how does she develop in this opera?
It's interesting because this role was written for me. So Harriet Chessman, who is, I'll give the short version of this, I don't know if you spoke about it, she is the mother of a woman who is a director, Marissa Wolf, and she's also the artistic director of the Portland Center Stage now. But when we met, we were working in a small independent company called Crowded Fire in San Francisco, and Marissa had taken over and was our artistic director and directing a bunch of shows. And what was amazing is that when Georg decided he wanted to work with Harriet, and then Harriet wanted to write this opera, this piece, and I was like, I'm not a singer, but Georg assured me it was going to be all right. What Harriet said to me was that she took her inspiration for who Sikorax was from me, which was sort of like intimidating, because I was like, oh my gosh, like, is that how you see me? Is some incredibly like powerful person, like restoring justice and light and peace and love to the world? So no pressure there. But to me, what this story is so much about is about the struggle of women, specifically women of color, against systems that are imposed upon our bodies, upon our lands, upon our children. And so it's really profound for me to be inhabiting this role, because I see her so much as someone who is powerful, but also wounded. And as an African-American woman, there's this whole trope and idea of us being strong and powerful, but that doesn't pay any attention or give any room for the vulnerability, which you see here in this piece. Like, you get to see her being very vulnerable. Mm. And struggling, and having, you know, as we were finding in the rehearsal the other day, yesterday I think it was, that low point where she absolutely is at the ebb tide and feels alone until she is restored again to some extent by her connection with the spirits and with Ariel and with the land. And so for me, this is about finding yourself and finding your own strength and knowing when to let go and when to give room and when to hold tight. There's so much that's happening in there for her.
And how, when do you feel the vulnerability so clearly in this piece? Where does that happen?
There's a scene with her and Caliban after, so they reunite and then they go off and then you see them back. And then Caliban's like, why did you rescue them?
Yeah. Caliban is her son.
Caliban is my son, who has been taken from me because I've been in a coma, essentially. at the behest of this dude
yeah.
for a decade. And then, so we are trying to reconnect. And like any reconnection, it's not easy. You know, he asks a very hard question, which is very interesting from a child's perspective. Like, why would you rescue them? And then for her, it's obvious. I could not let them die in the same way that our family died. And then Caliban's breakdown really brings her further down to realize this situation might not be fixable. There may not be a way for me to heal my son. He might be so damaged by 10 years of abuse that he can't come back.
Can you elaborate why you chose not to punish Prospero, because you have the power in the
yeah.
opera, you get the power to
yeah.
actually really punish
and
know,
threaten him. Like, I'm like, you know, these are the things I could do to you.
Yeah.
And
so why does Sycorax not just kill the dude?
I'll tell you, I think part of it is, if you look again at what punishment is, for many people, for example, don't believe in the death penalty for humanitarian reasons, that murder is never right.
Hmm.
And so then what do you do to punish people? You take away their freedom, which is widely considered to be the worst thing. The next worst thing to actual death is a loss of freedom. And Sycorax, I believe, in that moment of rage of I could do all of these things to you, then sees the impact that has that the past 10 years has had on the two children
yeah.
and sees their pain. And hears them share their story of this is why I'm hurting. And then I think Caliban's realization of you will never hear the spirits. She's like, you know what? That's right. You will never be in touch with the world as we are. You trapped in your narcissistic, capitalistic, exploitive world. That is, you know, as Georg says, you know, hell is a miserable life.
Mm.
And her belief is that it is far worse a punishment for him to know of paradise and not be able to attain it.
Yeah.
Like that is far worse. That she knows that she is condemning him to every waking moment for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
To want that again.
Yeah.
Even if it's for shitty reasons, even if it's for his, you know, I could get some more out of that land. I could exploit it further. He still can't have that. There's nothing he will gain.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, we are looking at, you know, the Shakespeare story, The Tempest, and a sort of sequel to that. And we are looking at this beautiful piece by Shakespeare from a sort of post-colonial.
Right.
It's over. You know? No, I mean, you know, and then the question is, how are we healing and how are we doing this? And I keep wondering if this magic of the island, we keep calling it a sort of a magic,
yeah.
but if it's not just like a metaphor for being in tune with the reality of that island.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can go to an island and conquer it and rule over it, but the question is, will you ever understand not just the magic of the island, but the actual how it sounds, how it feels, how it resonates, basically.
How it works.
And this is what he doesn't get. What I find really beautiful in this opera is that Miranda gets it, even though she's
yeah.
not from there,
yeah.
even though, you know, she had to learn it, but she was apparently open enough.
As a child, right?
As a child or as a woman, as a, you know, growing into adulthood to sort of get this.
Mm-hmm.
And this I find also a sort of beautiful consolation somehow,
yeah.
that you don't have to be from a place to be able to tune into it. So that I think the message is beautifully layered, where Prospero is just stuck in
mm-hmm.
what he can't do,
right.
and Miranda is actually able to sort of transform into this
exactly.
person who can actually live on this island,
exactly.
and who can tune into it.
I mean, it's not saying, oh, okay, these white people came and did white people shit.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, no.
It's not black and white.
People
literally.
Came
yeah.
and were unable to adapt
yeah.
on the terms of the existing culture.
Yeah.
Which were, you know, this authenticity and the spirits and just being in touch with nature.
Yeah.
Right? And the idea that nature is something to be conquered and not lived with.
Yeah.
The idea, for example, that people go to Australia and are like, we have a problem with this bug, so we're going to bring these toads.
Hmm.
And it's like, oh, wow, you fucked up the entire ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly.
Congratulations.
Yeah, probably even without intentionally doing
no.
so, without knowing.
It's just saying, it's literally saying, I need this, and therefore this is what I'm willing to do to get it.
Yeah.
You know, I want these crops, and these crops are being assaulted. It's like, well, those crops aren't good crops for here.
Yeah.
Maybe plant something else. No, I want this.
Yeah. It's interesting that this, you know, this look on things is something that we really need now also in theater.
Hell
like
yeah.
Making new stories, writing new stories, making... I'm very happy that we are actually making an opera where we can say, you know, we can make a real new story,
mm-hmm.
that, a story of our time, of how we look at things. I was speaking to a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago, and he was doing an opera, and he told me the synopsis, and then, you know, and blah, 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 whatever, whatever. And then at the end,
a new piece.
Yeah. And then at the end, the woman dies. And I said, what the hell?
Why?
I mean, how many operas have we had where the woman
died?
So I'm very happy that here, the woman is not only a fierce black African-American, but she also gets to live even more, you know, more so
opera
than ever.
Opera is so stuck on that. Like the libretto that was canceled by the opera house that commissioned Georg.
Mm.
Like one of their complaints was that it was just so naive and so unrealistic and so whatever. I'm like, what is naive? What is unrealistic? Oh, I'm sorry, the women win. I get it.
isn't it great? I was wondering, is it somehow in the United States, because you live in New York, is it somehow more advanced than in Europe, is your feeling, or maybe not?
The discussion
so much.
About, yes, definitely. Here's the thing. In what I did not know was that the tradition of how opera is produced in Europe is so fixed and so strict and so inflexible. And if you say, I have a new idea, there's an instant no. And then you have to push through the no to get a maybe. And then again, it's no. And in the U.S., there's a desperation. I feel like opera people in the U.S. are like, what can we do to get an audience?
Mm.
And sometimes it gets sort of sticky. You know, you get like, oh, we have this famous movie director directing an opera. You know, oh, we have this $10 billion arts building. And now it's going to be like a 3-story, 7-hour experience with projections and this and that. Like, they're throwing a lot of money at stuff.
I mean, that's happening everywhere in the sense that we're all looking for new ways of doing stuff and getting audience in. I don't think that is a lot different in the States than here, maybe. But what could be, what I sense is a little bit different is that you have a different younger tradition.
That's,
you know,
100% true.
Where maybe it's a little bit easier to change things. And in theater, it's even easier than in opera. Because, you know, in theater, you make new stories the entire time. And in opera, of course, we have these wonderful masterworks.
But that's kind of it. You can't, there's no way to chip your way into that.
Exactly. It's very hard to sort of remodel this thing. So finally, we have now a story that is really a new story where you have two people in the cast who are in the, it's written in the score, they are black. They have to be, we have a black tenor, we have, of course, you as the main character.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because we just like to be diverse, but it's because the story is really about this and they need to be.
Here's the thing though, the fact that this company not only respected that, but was like, great, fantastic, is unusual here in Europe. And this is a huge difference. Is that if I go to, I have a friend of mine, this is hilarious. So my massage therapist has a friend who runs an opera company somewhere in the South, like in Georgia, like Atlanta, one of the bigger opera companies she works for. And she was like, I'll talk to them and see if she might be interested in talking to you about an opera. And then she comes back the next week and is like, yeah, she totally wants to talk to you. Like, this is how it works there.
Yeah.
And when I told her, I said, well, did you mention that this is a specific casting? She was like, oh no, they're totally very much about expanding the faces and the experiences that are brought to the stage.
Yeah.
And seeing that that has a value versus in Europe where people are like, well, isn't that reverse racism if you specify that they have to be black or they have to be Japanese? And I'm like, wow, how do you even begin to deconstruct the idea that A, you can say the words reverse racism to me, because that's not a thing, and B, that you don't get that the beauty of having this diversity is not political correctness. It's first of all that it just tastes, the texture and the flavor of it is different because you have people from so many different experiences bringing that to the stage. Mm. You know, I'm not going to sound the same as an actor who was born and raised in downtown Bern.
Yeah.
We're going to have different spiritual experiences, and that's going to be on stage. You know, the idea that I'm playing a character is fine, but in reality, you have to bring yourself into that role.
Yeah, and it's also, I also have the feeling that it's the moment for, for a certain kind of militantism that needs to happen now.
Yeah.
And then probably at some point you reach a new balance, and then we don't need the militantism
exactly.
anymore. You know,
I
have to tell the story so often when we're talking about gay pride, you know, mm-hmm. and people ask me, you know, why is it so important? It's like, if it weren't for those dudes in New York in Stonewall, you know, who made the riots, we would still...
There was
a couple of dozen
pissed off half-drunk queens.
I would still not be able, you know, to hold hands on the street.
Yeah.
And the same for, you know, for this whole Me Too movement, which is now very out there, and
mm-hmm.
also for diversity in opera or in theater or wherever. Maybe this is the moment where it has to be a little bit more militant and where
Absolutely.
It has to be a bit more out there. And then hopefully in 20 years we look back and it's like, oh yeah, this is a little
Remember
bit more...
Remember when we had to like make
exactly.
a big deal?
This is a little bit
well,
old-fashioned.
Yeah. We're the Metropolitan Opera, for the first time 2 years ago, made a specific statement that they would not use any black or yellow face in their productions.
Hmm.
2 years ago. Right? Last year, I guess, was the first time the Met had a non-white librettist and composer in their opera. Right? Like in the year 100 and some odd years into it, and there's entire swaths of Europe that have not hit that benchmark.
Yeah, sure.
And to say, well, is it because there's not enough librettists of color? I don't think so. I think it's because there's zero effort made to say, hey, who is opera for? And how do we get folks who are not old white people to care?
Yeah.
And part of the reason is tell stories that are not just old white people. Romeo and Juliet is not something that's performed over and over again because of the Shakespeare. It's because of West Side Story. It's because of like every adaptation. It's because of Romeo and Juliet on the moon.
Yeah.
It's because that story translates to everybody,
yeah.
everywhere. You know, there's Romeo and Juliet has been translated into indigenous Native American dialects and performed. You know, it's the shit is so real. And when you take it and you move it into a different cultural lens, it's still alive. And this is what I hope opera can do, is to see that this is life. That this is how you keep things alive, is to breathe other folk stories into what you're seeing on stage. You know?
Absolutely. That is a beautiful message of hope, which we're working on. No, but, you know, without trying to. Beautiful. I'm going to, of course, in my podcast, I wanna add a little note on how we work together.
Yeah.
Because that was also very beautiful. We did a piece called Hyena with you reciting a beautiful text that you wrote yourself. And Klang von Wien playing it.
Yeah.
And Georg wrote fabulous music to accompany this story. We'll hear a couple of minutes of the ending, and we get an idea also of how this music will sound and how you will sound in this opera.
Yeah.
Do you want to say something about that piece?
I will say first that it was so interesting to me when I asked Georg, I was like, is this a thing that's normally done in your world? And he was like, not really. Not really. And I said, because this is not unusual for the theater world, because this is directly what spoken word comes from, is, you know, someone doing freestyle verse poetry with someone playing an instrument, or two people, like you might have like a drummer and a saxophonist. Or whatever. And then they would just, you know, get into the flow and do their thing. And I said, so this is very much in that tradition. you know, obviously you as old white dude from Europe are bringing in a whole new energy to that. But what was sort of difficult and also miraculous about it was that I said, you know, I cannot specifically predict how long I'm going to need for each of these pieces. I really need to be able to like breathe, feel the audience, because this is the thing about storytelling is that you are definitely 100% engaged with the audience.
Yeah.
It's not like an opera where I need to forget that they're there for long periods of time. And so Georg created this new structure, which I will tell you, like, he was so glad that you were doing it, because he's like, I'm not sure that like a normal conductor would be able to. I was like, we need super boss. And you did. And it was terrifying for me, because I basically had to come in and say, here's why I suck as an actor, but I'm taking that weakness, I'm gonna say, you know, for me, I can't just like, I'm just, my brain just doesn't work that way. And Georg said, that's all right, I'm gonna create this structure. And you were like, okay, fine, I can work with that. And came up with these really great ways to have that flexibility so that it was almost like a jazz sort of performance where
Absolutely.
You would have these moments of flow and then you would hit back to the theme and everyone would get back on board and then the drum solo would happen and then, you know, that goes on. And so that's what it very much felt like to me. And it was really great that you were able to bridge the gap for me between being someone who is a damaged retired musician from my childhood to having the strength and the capacity and the confidence to feel supported.
Yeah, it was also, it was really very easy because you, we're tickling each other now in this dressing room. But, you know, you're such a force of nature on stage, like in life as well. But on stage, you know, it's so compelling what you do that it wasn't really very difficult. I mean, we had to do some tricky accountancy to make sure that we align, but you know, the building the story together with you was actually very easy. And the same goes for this opera. It's you know, sometimes you take a bit more time, sometimes you take a bit less time, but the way the story unfolds is so very clear when you're doing it that, you know, following that is really not that difficult and is very beautiful. Anyway, We're going to listen to a little bit of Hyena, where you tell the story of how you overcame your addiction. And we're going to hear Klang von Wien playing beautiful music by Georg Friedrich Haas.
You always assume you will remember vividly the day, the time, the date. Was it a Thursday or a Sunday? You always assume you will remember, have burned into your unconsciousness the big, important moments in your life. Pivotal things like, where were you when the Challenger blew up? When Flight 175 hit the South Tower? How my parents remember where they were when John F. was assassinated? Or Bobby was murdered? Or King was slaughtered? Or Malcolm X was executed? You assume that the big moments leave emotional forensics behind, but sometimes they just don't. To this day, I cannot tell you what day it was when I walked into the bathroom to see my dead eyes looking back at me from the mirror, staring at me from a mirror that had been mine for over a decade. That mirror had seen me through many a day and night, but it had never, you know, it had never not shown me what I expected to see, which was me. Because what else do you see when you look into a mirror? But that day, that morning, or was it afternoon? That day, I saw a body that had been abandoned by whatever it was that makes us live. I looked to see myself dead.
Is there anything else we want to
I just
want to
say
cover?
Thank you, because this process is really hard. It's so difficult, and it's added difficulty because, for me, having Georg present is great as my partner and as support, but then also just him as the composer has its own sort of weight. And normally I'm supporting him through this birth pain because he is so sensitive and so, like, anxious and so nervous. And I'm like, I can't be there for
you right now.
You're
a performer yourself.
You know,
you
I was like, I
both.
Have my own shit
yeah,
to
yeah,
deal
yeah.
with.
Yeah.
And I am now looking at... This is the biggest production I have been in.
It's going to be fabulous. And we'll kick him out at some rehearsals with
you. Yeah, yeah. And he's totally fine with that. He understands. He's not
yeah.
at all a dick or resentful about it. He's
absolutely.
Just he's going to be like, "Great, you're right. I'm out."
Yeah.
He was just so glad that you did invite him for some of the rehearsals. He's like I was like, "Are you coming?" He's like, "Boss invited me."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Well, I guess I've been overruled."
Yeah, we'll.
But it's so and it's so great to have him there. And this is the other thing about having Harriet as the librettist and being able to talk to her, you know, and when the director and dramaturg are like, we have questions about this, and there's discussion, and it's alive and it's breathing.
Yeah.
And this for me is such a beautiful full circle, because the theater company I worked with in San Francisco for 15 years, Crowded Fire, did almost exclusive, like the vast majority of the work we did was new work.
Mm.
And so we would have the playwright. One of the things we would do is for the first week of rehearsal, we'd have the playwright in the room. And we would just hash out, we would have all of our table work initially was with the playwright.
Mm.
Because our goal was to present to the playwright the closest, as close as we could get to what they saw when they were sitting, you know, in front of that blank page.
Yeah.
To get to there. And I feel like this is what's happening here.
Absolutely. Interestingly enough, the working process is also a bit more a theater working process.
Yes.
With lots of talking and lots of
yeah.
discussing and all that. Than an opera process, which is good. It works for this
yeah,
piece very,
yeah.
very well. And I think it's very important that we're all sort of in this process, you
yeah.
know, living it together
yeah.
and also understanding what we're making and why we're making it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's gorgeous.
I want to thank you for being here and being such a fabulous performer.
Thank you.
And a human being.
Yay. Thank you, boss.
Thank you, Melina.
It's the love story. Of the conductor and this fat bitch.